knocked him out of Game 6 with an elbow to the head, Pippen said, there were times a few years before the flagrant foul rules when guys would have a breakaway and the Pistons would cut their legs out from under them. Anything to win a game. That's not the way the game is supposed to be played. I remember once when Michael had a breakaway and Laimbeer took him out. There was no way he could have blocked the shot. When you were out there playing them, that was always in the back of your mind, to kind of watch yourself. As Jordan predicted, his developing friendship with Dumars did nothing to dull the competition between the two teams. The Pistons continued to flaunt their much-ballyhooed Jordan rules, which were really just simple common sense, force Jordan to give up the ball, gang up on him as much as possible, knock him to the floor, and make things really ugly. The matchup always seemed to inspire the worst sort of paranoia among the Bulls, both players and coaches, who seethed over videotapes the Detroit coaching staff had sent to the league offices, suggesting that Jordan was benefiting from too many unwarranted foul calls. Earlier in the playoffs, Detroit's John Sally had pointed out for reporters that the Pistons were a team and the Bulls were a one-man show. "There's not one guy who sets the tone on our team," Sally remarked with a smile. "That's what makes us a team. If one guy did everything, we wouldn't be a team. We'd be the Chicago Bulls." Indeed, Jordan's own teammates were quite aware of the difficulty of playing alongside their leader. As former teammate Dave Corzine had once pointed out, if anything went wrong for the team, it was never Jordan's fault. Somebody else always took the blame. Despite the best efforts of the coach to install the ball-sharing triangle, Jordan still dominated the club, to the point that Craig Hodges and others referred to him as the General. True to form, the Pistons slammed Jordan around in Game 1 of the 1990 Conference Finals. Detroit hit only 33 of 78 from the floor, and one of those was an Isaiah Thomas lob pass to John Sally that inadvertently went in the basket. As always, the Pistons' hell-for-leather defense saved them. "It was more like a rugby match," Phil Jackson said glumly. The key effort for Detroit was 27 points and plenty of defense from Dumars. He slowed Jordan to 34 points. The rest of the Chicago starters scored a total of 31, which was enough for a blueprint bad boys win, 86-77, and a confirmation of Sally's snide remark. Jordan got banged up after flying high into the lane in the first quarter. A group of Pistons led by Dennis Rodman laid him down on the floor, bruising his hip. "I think I had my legs cut out from under me," he said afterward. "And if so, I don't know who did it. I think it's the type of injury that could linger." It did linger, at least into the next battle. The Pistons snatched a 43-26 lead in the middle of the second quarter of Game 2, while Jordan opened stiffly. Chicago trailed 53-38 at the half when Jordan entered the locker room, kicked a chair, and stormed at his teammates. "We're playing like a bunch of pussies." Chastised, they returned to the floor in the second half with much more energy, and Jordan finally warmed enough to put the Bulls back in front 67-66 at the 8:24 mark of the third period. But it was short-lived. Dumars finished with 31 points on 12 of 19 from the floor, giving the Pistons a 2-0 series lead with a 102-93 win. Meanwhile, Jordan made just 5 of 16 shots to finish with 20 points. Immediately afterward, he ripped into the Bulls for their uninspired performance and left the locker room without speaking to reporters. He would later suggest that his criticism was directed at himself as much as his teammates. The writers gathered around Dumars in the Detroit locker room and asked him how he had stopped Jordan. The Pistons guard paused and looked up at the ceiling as if searching for help. "You don't stop Jordan," he explained. The obvious answer was that for the first two games, he had gone at Jordan offensively and lit him up. At least that's what Jordan's irritated teammates pointed out privately. But at a practice following the first two losses, Jordan grew infuriated when he thought Pippen and Grant were goofing around and failing to take the situation seriously. For much of his tenure in Chicago, Johnny Bock had painstakingly edited and produced the scouting videotapes of opponents that the coaches showed before each playoff game. The assistant coach often spliced in war movie clips to illustrate basketball points, but Jackson himself wanted to take over the job from Bock that first season. He illustrated the videotapes during the Piston series with clips from The Wizard of Oz. He took a clip of Dumars zipping past Jordan on a drive, then spliced in a shot of the Scarecrow. After another mistake, Jackson showed a shot of the Cowardly Lion, and after another, the Tin Woodsman, all to the amusement of the players, until John Paxson pointed out that the coach was basically insinuating his players had no heart, no courage, and no brains. Fortunately, this negative tenor eased in Game 3 in Chicago Stadium. Jordan defended better, scored 47, and got enough help from his teammates for a 107-102 win. Isaiah Thomas had broken out of a 5-for-21 shooting slump to score 36, but the Bulls won the rebounding battle 46-36, and second shots gave them the edge and a victory. At one point in Game 4, the Bulls held a 19-point lead, but Dumars scored 24 points and again led the Pistons' charge. Twice the lead was cut to 3, but the Bulls made 18 of 22 free throws to maintain their edge. While the Pistons out-rebound the Bulls 52-37, they couldn't sink baskets, hitting only 29 of 78 attempts. On a bad ankle, Detroit's Dennis Rodman had 20 points and 20 rebounds, but Jordan delivered bigger with 42 points, and Chicago's other four starters finished in double figures in a 108-101 Bulls win. Suddenly, the bad boys, who like to keep the pressure on the opponent, found themselves facing a must-win situation at home. Both James Edwards and Bill Laimbeer shook off their slumps for Game 5 and helped the Pistons take a 3-2 series lead with a 97-83 win as Dumars held Jordan to 22 points. Sick with fever and a cold, the Detroit guard had played 38 minutes. With Jordan, there's nothing you can do but work, hope, and pray, and Joe did all three, Chuck Daly said. Dumars played the series with a sort of heart for which Jordan would later be lionized, but his performance would become almost forgotten in sports history. Jordan's message seemed to have gotten through to his teammates, however. The Pistons returned to Chicago, held Jordan to 29 points, and still lost Game 6 in a blowout. The Bulls forced the Pistons into 25% shooting in the third period and expanded a 3-point edge into an 80-63 lead to open the fourth. Detroit lost 109-91, and like that, the Bulls had forced a seventh game. "We were more driven than ever to win this thing," Jordan declared. Game 7, however, quickly turned disastrous for Chicago. Paxson was nursing a badly sprained ankle, and Pippen developed a migraine headache just before tip-off. "Scotty had had migraines before," trainer Mark File explained. "He actually came to me before the game and said he couldn't see. I said, 'Can you play?' He started to tell me no, and Michael jumped in and said, 'Hell yes, he can play. Start him. Let him play blind.'" Horace Grant kind of backed up a little bit in the game too, File added. "It was more a matter of maturity than wimping out. It took a certain period of time before they would stand up and say, 'Damn it, I've been pushed in the wall enough.' Scotty played with a headache, and as the game went on, he got better." The Bulls, however, did not. The second period was particularly awful, and Chicago never recovered. The Pistons advanced with a blowout, 93-74. "My worst moment as a Bull was trying to finish out the seventh game that we lost to the Pistons in the Palace," Jackson recalled. "There was Scottie Pippen with a migraine on the bench, and John Paxson had sprained his ankle in the game before. I had to sit there and grit my teeth and go through a half in which we were struggling to get in the ball game. We had just gone through a second period that was an embarrassment to the organization. It was my most difficult moment as a coach." Furious with his teammates, Jordan cursed them yet again at halftime, then sobbed in the back of the team bus afterward. "I was crying and steaming," he recalled. "I was saying, 'Hey, I'm out here busting my butt and nobody else is doing the same thing. These guys are kicking our butt, taking our heart, taking our pride. I made up my mind right then and there it would never happen again. That was the summer that I first started lifting weights. If I was going to take some of this beating, I was going to start dishing out some of it. I got tired of them dominating me physically." With each Chicago loss in the playoffs, critics had grown more convinced that the Bulls were flawed as a one-man team. "They kept running into Detroit, and it didn't look like they had any idea of how to beat Detroit," recalled journalist David Aldridge. Some observers pointed out that it had taken Wilt Chamberlain, Jerry West, and Oscar Robertson years to lead teams to the NBA title, and perhaps Jordan fell into the category with those players. Others wondered if he weren't headed for the same anguish as Elgin Baylor, Nate Thurmond, Pete Maravich, and Dave Bing, all great players who never played on a championship team. Jordan was infuriated by such speculation and the criticism. He was literally nauseated by the losses each year to Detroit. Losing to Isaiah Thomas was very difficult. In some ways, however, the burden of the loss fell on Pippen. Everyone from the media to his own teammates had interpreted the headache as a sign of faint-heartedness. Lost in the perspective was the fact that the third-year forward had recently buried his father. "I'm flying back from the migraine game," recalled Cheryl Ray Stout. "And who should be sitting across from me but Juanita Jordan? And she says, What happened to Scotty? I said, he had a headache. She goes, he had a headache? And she just shook her head. After his biggest games, Jordan liked to save his shoes and store them for posterity. After the Game 7 loss, he wanted no mementos. The last time they lost to the Pistons, we were all checking out of the hotel room and Scotty was in there with him, recalled Lacey Banks, who often claimed Jordan's game shoes as a donation to auction off for the local heart association. He said, I don't want any of this stinky stuff. Here, Lacey, take these old stinky shoes. I don't want to see them anymore. Mostly, Joe Dumars would remember the pain on his face at the end of Game 7. I saw it in his eyes, Dumars said. He came and shook hands and quietly said, congratulations, good luck. I remember seeing the hurt and disappointment in his face. I saw a deep hurt. It was going to take far more than Phil Jackson's burning sage to purify Jordan and his Bulls. Jordan wasn't sure what would be needed, but he knew that it was he who would have to force the agenda. With Phil, we lost again, Mark File recalled. After that, Michael said, hey, now we gotta go over the top, and I'm gonna take us there. If you don't want to be on the boat, get off. Chapter 25. The God of Basketball. It was the odor of piss that somehow played on Sonny Vaccaro's mind years later. They were in a godforsaken bathroom on a U.S. Army base in Germany in late August 1990. Michael Jordan was about to play against himself in basketball for about 2,000 troops packed into a tiny gym. He had not wanted to make a trip, which took him away from golf and from Juanita, now 5 months pregnant with son Marcus, who would be born on Christmas Eve. But here he was in Europe, thanks to Vaccaro's moxie and guile, which had begun to wear dangerously thin with Nike chairman Phil Knight. The world was on edge as the Gulf War had just gotten underway, but Jordan had his own reasons not to pack up and head to Europe for 10 days that summer. The Game 7 loss to the Pistons in May had cast a certain mindset over the entire Bulls roster and brought surprising focus to the offseason. The anger had sparked a constructive optimism among his teammates, and Jordan wanted to be able to seize that moment. This Nike trip proposed by Vaccaro was scheduled to occur right before training camp opened, so he'd have to rush back to Chicago. The last thing Jordan wanted to do was jam up his schedule with any sort of public silliness. Playing in an exhibition game for U.S. troops held a certain appeal, although he preferred to keep such events very low-key. Mostly, he thought he could get in a visit with older brother Ronnie, and that made the trip worthwhile. An even more questionable item on the itinerary was Jordan's commitment to play for both sides in an All-Star game that opened the Spanish League season. It made absolutely no sense to interject Jordan into the Spanish League's big moment, except for the chance to broadcast America's brightest star in action to much of the Spanish-speaking world. The whole thing felt strange. Plus, wartime travel presented huge security issues. Only after Vaccaro commandeered a Nike corporate jet and made detailed security plans at each stop, did Jordan warm to the idea. It was a public relations tour, Vaccaro explained. It was the first one Nike ever did like this. It was huge. Michael did the first of anything we ever did, and I went with him. This junket would become the prototype tour for a generation of American pro basketball stars promoting shoes over the ensuing 2 decades. But at the time, there was another, darker reason for the hastily planned escape. That summer, Nike had gotten embroiled in an ugly public relations spat with Jesse Jackson's Operation Push. Reverend Tyrone Crider, one of Jackson's young lieutenants, had taken over as Push executive director and targeted the shoe industry's lack of involvement in the African-American community. Crider's complaint with Nike was that the Oregon company had no black board members, no black vice presidents, and a scarcity of black department heads. Nike had deals with other black endorsers beyond Jordan, and Crider acknowledged as much. But the Push leader said that he was taking on Nike because in a few short years, it had become the industry leader. The company and Push had begun discussions that summer, but they ended abruptly when Push demanded to see Nike's books, and Nike countered with its own demand to peek inside Push's finances. Crider responded by ordering a boycott of Nike products by African Americans. Don't buy Nike. Don't wear Nike, he said in announcing the campaign on August 12th. Some observers suggested that Crider had miscalculated in taking on Nike, that Push would surely lose. Still, the company wanted no showdown with Push and made offers to rectify any shortage of African Americans in its power structure. This effort would eventually boost Jordan's own position with the company and help provide impetus for the creation of the Jordan brand. But in the interim, the Star was in danger of being drawn into a nasty dispute with headlines in major papers across the country. The last thing Nike wanted was to see Air Jordan on TV being hit with questions about the conflict. On August 15th, Jordan released a statement saying that all of corporate America needed to provide opportunities, but that Push's targeting of Nike was out of bounds. It is unfair to single out Nike just because they are on top, his statement read. After releasing his comments, he departed quickly for Europe. Just as Sonny Vaccaro had once come up with an idea to put Jordan in the spotlight, he had now come up with something that would take him out of it. Nike would make changes, and Kreider would leave Push after the boycott fizzled out in early 1991 when it became clear that African-American buyers were reluctant to stop buying the shoes. Still, the incident served notice to Jordan that such highly charged issues could and would create headaches regarding his business interests. The 1990s would bring allegations by human rights organizations that Nike was employing hundreds of sweatshops worldwide in the manufacturing of its products, an issue that would quickly ensnare Jordan in his growing roles with the company. Jordan had also found himself caught in another huge issue that summer of 1990 when he was asked, through his mother, to endorse the campaign of Harvey Gantt, an African-American Democrat who was trying to pry the hardline conservative Jesse Helms out of his U.S. Senate seat representing North Carolina. It was a close, racially charged campaign, made famous by Helms's Hands political ad that showed a white man losing his job to a minority because of unfair racial quotas. The ad, written by Republican strategist Alex Castellanos, played on white resentment. When asked to get involved in the campaign, Jordan had famously told Gantt's people that he couldn't because Republicans buy shoes too. Politics had not been the path to prosperity for his grandfather Edward Peoples, nor for generations of black North Carolinians, and it wasn't a priority for Dolores Jordan or her son in 1990. The response angered many, and yet pleased many others. Lacey Banks and others in Chicago shook their heads. It was not, Banks would note years later, the kind of answer that Muhammad Ali would have chosen. The refusal to help Gantt, who lost the race, incensed social activist and former NFL star Jim Brown, who said of Jordan, "He's more interested in his image for shoe deals than he is in helping his own people." At the other end of the spectrum were people like Kenny Gattison, who had played against Jordan since high school. He said that the comment made possible Jordan's full crossover as a product endorser because he stayed free of political controversy. "That's what made him an icon," Gattison offered, "because he never uttered a word and never gave people a reason to bash him." Looking back in 2008, Michael Wilbon observed in his Washington Post column, "It seemed to officially usher in a period in which athletes made a conscious choice of commerce over politics. Neutrality offended fewer people. African-American athletes, with Jordan leading the way, appealed commercially for the first time to the mainstream." Jordan would contribute to Gantt's second unsuccessful run at Helms, and later gave money to Democrat presidential contender Bill Bradley. Jordan even threw a very public fundraiser for Barack Obama during the 2012 presidential campaign. Still, the 1990 election brought a watershed moment in Jordan's public image. ESPN's J.A. Adande recalled the moment as a demarcation for many of his friends in their worship of his airness. "I had friends that wanted absolutely nothing to do with Michael Jordan because of that," Adande said, "because they thought he was derelict in his social duties. They couldn't get over that. They couldn't enjoy Jordan the player because they really didn't have any respect for Jordan the person." Adande himself couldn't fathom why Jordan wouldn't want to take on a known racist. Pushed on the issue by GQ magazine several years later, Jordan explained that at age 27, he was focused on building his basketball career, not on politics. "I later understood that, but when I was younger, I agreed with Jim Brown," longtime NBA journalist David Aldridge recalled. "I was like, come on, Michael, you can take a stand on this. You're Michael Jordan. What are they going to do to you?" I was horrified. Literally, I was like, come on, Michael, you can't be that venal, or that crass. It can't always be about you. It's got to be about something bigger than you, because our whole life as black people, it's always been about something bigger than us. That's why you do the things that you do, because there's people who were ahead of you that made it possible for you to do that. I thought, how could Michael Jordan not take a stand on this, or how could he not support Harvey Gantt? I agreed with a lot of people that took him to task for that. The longtime NBA reporter said the moment was a pivot point. Endorsing Gantt might well have sent Jordan off in another direction, in which he could have been appreciated as someone who stood up for social justice instead of standing up for self-interest. "I remember him saying one time, I'm not a politician, Lacey Banks recalled in 2011. Mike had a weakness in that. He never really aggressively identified with the mainstream causes. Given his discomfort over such public confrontations, it made sense that Jordan decided to get away with Sonny Vaccaro to Europe that August, just as things were heating up. With Michael, it was always that trust thing, Vaccaro explained. He listened. I was the guy he listened to. He didn't want to go. The Gulf War had just started. It was a perilous time. I asked him to go. I made Nike give me a private plane. We took a private plane so we had security. We went to private airports. We had the guys in uniforms. The guns were there. What a trip it was. We went to Paris. We went to Germany. We went to Spain. Which was how they ended up in that funky old bathroom on the army base in Germany. With no marketing woes to worry about, Germany would prove to be the emotional part of the journey, with the troops gathered and still so many unknowns about the conflict. Plus, his brother Ronnie would be there. Michael judged the dunk contest and played on an army-based team, Vaccaro recalled. It was all Nike-related sponsors. He played against himself for the soldiers in Germany. He played in the game in a small gym, maybe 2,000 soldiers are there. The game plan was he was going to play for 5 or 10 minutes for Team A, then he'd play 5 or 10 minutes for Team B. Then we'd sneak out the back door to the limo, cause the crowds were all there, and the media, and you couldn't get in this little gym. Jordan and Vaccaro sought refuge in the gym's ancient restroom. There was a bench and old-style open urinals, a long metal trough that stank, hardly the kind of accommodations that were anticipated when Vaccaro sold the idea of a grand European marketing junket. Jordan never said a word about the conditions. I closed the door right before the start of the game, Vaccaro recalled. We're in there, just the two of us. I go to the bathroom and he's bouncing the ball. I had closed the door. And then someone comes and says it's time to start the game. I said, let's go, Michael. He said, no, leave me alone for another minute. Vaccaro studied Jordan a moment before realizing what was happening. That sucker was getting ready to play this game. Why am I saying this? He was bouncing the ball getting ready for the game. That's who he is. He was going to play his best, no matter what the hell the atmosphere or the circumstances were. He was in a pissy old urinal in goddamn Germany, and he's getting ready to play the game like it's UNC against Georgetown in the Superdome. That shows you the mentality he's carried throughout his whole life. Jordan tore into that first half, driving his team to a lead. In this game, his opponents were Americans, and it was easier to read them on the floor. He still took those early moments to gauge what he faced, but from there he attacked in fierce Jordan fashion, producing steals in head-spinning numbers, slashing to the rim, toying with three-pointers, and when the action slowed, posting up just to test the people around him. On the court, he's a bastard, Sonny Vaccaro remembered thinking. Jordan may not have known what to do with the politics of protest, but he certainly had no equivocation about competing. The situation was love of the game personified. Instead of playing limited minutes each half, Jordan consumed the entire game. He plays for Team A the first half for 20 minutes, Vaccaro recalled. Then halftime, he changes his jersey and plays for Team B. The halftime score, if Vaccaro remembered correctly, was 40-25 for Michael's team. Now he changes his jersey and he plays for the other team. The players he had just humbled now became his teammates, just as if he was back in a Bulls practice where Doug Collins had decided to do a switcheroo. So Jordan began searching through his new roster, trying to find out who would stand up and who wouldn't. You can guess the story, Vaccaro said. End of the game, it was like 82-80. Michael beat himself. He played all 40 minutes of the game with the soldiers. The real marketing segment of the trip came in Barcelona, where preparations for the 1992 Olympics were underway. Jordan made highly publicized visits to the offices of Nike, to the Olympic staff, even to Associated Club Basketball, the Spanish league offices. They wanted Michael to go to Barcelona, and he actually put a shovel in the ground for the new stadium they were building for the 1992 Olympics, Vaccaro explained. He did one press conference in Madrid and another in Barcelona. He was the jury in a slam dunk contest at the Spanish All-Star Game, put on by Nike for young people. And once again he played himself, this time with the Spanish pros. Jordan took a little longer to read his European opponents, trying to sense their different game. It helped that he had the Olympic experience from 1984. He floated a few jumpers, got his bearings, and then went to work, all to the delight of the packed arena in Barcelona. The Spanish crowds cheered Jordan's every move, leaving fans and media alike to declare that the god of the basketball had descended into their presence. Jordan's grand reception would help drive something akin to a coronation in Barcelona 2 years later. It promoted Nike on a grand scale, Vaccaro said of his brainchild. Now, Michael was an icon. The trip marked a subtler but perhaps larger personal transformation for Jordan, beginning with the fact that he had listened, Vaccaro explained. So much of what had been done before had rested on Dolores Jordan's guidance, but Vaccaro saw the first real emergence of the business and marketing force that Jordan was becoming. He was leaving behind the mindset of a petulant young prince and was taking ownership of the brand, doing what was necessary to make it grow. He was applying his work ethic and competitive spirit and maturity to something beyond basketball. Not that Jordan hadn't always tended to his responsibilities, but now it was as if the adolescent who had vowed to never have a job had finally gotten one. Slam Dunk. During a whirlwind spin through the City of Light, taking in the Seine and Champs-Élysées and the Arc de Triomphe, Jordan had so much fun he told a friend that seeing the sights got him to thinking about co-owning a team in Europe and playing there after he retired from the NBA. The change was obvious, Vaccaro said. For much of my time with him, during those first years in the NBA, he still was a young kid feeling his oats, partying, girlfriends, and all that stuff before he and Juanita got married. I was part of that whole thing. I saw it. Now he's maturing. He now knows what he has. He was assuming responsibility with his empire off the court with Nike. He was becoming a part owner now. His next contract would acknowledge what Phil Knight already begrudgingly knew, that the power of Michael Jordan had evolved into a full equity partnership with Nike, and Push had been there to guide the process along. His next contract would be the Jordan brand, Vaccaro said. Dee Brown got a taste of the new Jordan when the Celtics rookie guard won the slam dunk contest at the 1991 NBA All-Star Game in Charlotte. The only problem was, he felt a lot like the old Jordan. The NBA had tried to persuade him to enter the contest in his native Carolina, but Jordan had declined, figuring he had nothing to gain and much to lose. But when he arrived in Charlotte, his competitive juices started flowing as he watched Brown win the slam dunk contest with a soaring, blindfolded slam. What really mattered were the shoes on Brown's feet. Reebok's trendy pumps. Not long after the contest ended that Friday night, Brown found himself in a back tunnel waiting for another event to start. And suddenly, there was Jordan. It was weird, Brown recalled. I was a rookie and I had just won a contest maybe 2 hours before. It was just me and Michael and security. And I'm sitting there, so he comes up to me and says, "Good job, young fella. You did a really good job." Then he kind of said, "You know, I got to go at you more now." Brown was taken aback by the comment and more than a little intimidated. "Why?" he asked. Michael goes, "You know you've started a shoe war." I go, "What does that mean? I'm oblivious. This is Michael Jordan. I'm 21 years old, just won a dunk contest." I didn't comprehend what he said. He could have told me that my face is falling off. I would have been like, "Thank you." Later, Brown began to wonder, how did Jordan even know where he was? Had the star made a point to seek him out to put him on notice? The more he thought about it, the more he realized that Jordan had done just that. "I started figuring it out," Brown said. "You hear all the stories about Michael and how competitive he is. He already had it in his mind that what I did with that pump-up shoe, that what it was going to be, was a competition between his shoe and that shoe. Forget about basketball. It went to the competition of, now I got to kick your butt in something else. I know you can't guard me, I'm the best player in the world. But just because you did that little Reebok thing, now I got to step my game up on the shoe business." In a few short months, Jordan had stepped into a new identity that very few were aware of at the time. He was the player as shoe executive. As Vaccaro pointed out, Jordan was becoming far more accomplished in this business role than the public realized or understood. The Reebok pump kind of blew up a little bit for a time there, Brown said with a laugh in a 2012 interview, adding that soon enough, however, the issue was settled decisively. Obviously, Michael stepped the shoe game up. That tells you what kind of competition it turned out to be. Everybody is wearing Jordans now. The Wages of Change. The 27-year-old man with the unquenchable appetites and boundless energy finally returned Phil Jackson's phone calls early that fall of 1990 as training camp was set to open. The coach had been calling through much of the off-season, but Jordan had been off into everything, it seemed. At one point that summer, he had found time to play in a charity golf tournament in Philadelphia with Charles Barkley as his caddy. The two hit it off immediately. Chuck was immensely talented, and his sense of humor made it so much easier for Jordan to deal with all the bullshit that was now piling up around him. Somehow, Barkley always kept him chuckling. Soon enough, he had stitched into his life a running phone conversation with Sir Charles. Jordan had thought he could talk some shit, but Barkley? Jordan had to laugh when the Alabama fat boy told him he would be taking the league scoring title away from him for the upcoming season. When Jordan got back to Chicago and the Bulls that fall, he was sporting a diamond stud in his ear to go with his shaved head. It was a risky move for a guy to whom image was everything. Before long, the alpha male Jordan look could be seen everywhere, in men of all races and colors. Jordan and agent David Falk were also engaged in serious conversations about his move beyond basketball. They had begun to see the four corners of the basketball court as a limitation rather than a platform, Falk would later explain. Just that season, some business partners were set to release a line of evening wear for men, 23 Night for Michael Jordan, in partnership with After Six, the formal wear brand. "We've never had such excitement," Marilyn Spiegel, a vice president of marketing for After Six, told People magazine. "Michael is the 90s man." Jordan stood 6'6", weighed 195 pounds, with a 45-inch chest and a 33-inch waist, what would prove to be the perfect clothes horse of a model. Evening wear would simply be the next in a stream of products over the decade, clothing, fragrance, jewelry, underwear, and so on, that would define what came to be known as the metrosexual male. "I became very fashion conscious when I was young," Jordan told People, recalling his experience taking home economics at Laney High. "I picked up on different styles, and I would always want them, but I couldn't afford them." Now, of course, he could afford it all. But he had come to a point in his career that he no longer took great joy from the game that made it all possible. He hardly bothered watching NBA games when he was off. This was one of the themes in a book being developed behind the scenes by Chicago Tribune beat writer Sam Smith. Slated to be published in the fall of 1991, the book was based on information provided to Smith by unidentified sources in and around the team. It would reveal a monumentally selfish Jordan who had grown cynical, angry, bitter, and untrusting in his six NBA seasons. This was the situation that Phil Jackson faced as he sat down with Jordan for their first preseason powwow. Jackson recognized that he had come to a crossroads in just his second season coaching the team. He wanted to discuss how Michael and his Jordanaires, as they were called, would approach the upcoming schedule. Jordan had hoped the coach was going to tell him they were abandoning the triangle offense, but that was hardly the case. The coach not only expected the team to adhere to the system more closely, but he also informed Jordan that it would be better for the team if its star wasn't so focused on winning another scoring title. Perhaps Charles Barkley had been reading Jackson's mind. There was no pleasant end to the meeting, just as there would be no pleasant beginning to the season. As early as 1989, when the Bulls decided to put Pippen's mug on the upcoming season schedule, Jordan had come to believe that there was a de-Michaelization going on within the franchise, a determined effort to step out of the shadow he cast. He had heard inside reports of a Krause comment that if the team had Hakeem Olajuwon in his place, the Bulls would have won two titles already. He perceived a growing belief in the front office that he was not the kind of player who could anchor a championship team. In retrospect, it might seem ludicrous that he believed he wasn't being promoted. His face was all over the pro game, but those around him had long learned that reality and Jordan's competitive mind often inhabited parallel universes. More than ever, when he wanted to stoke the fire, he simply conjured up something in his mind to produce the heat. The people around him often had trouble separating the real from the imagined. What was undeniably real was the success of the Pistons' physical defense. Jordan knew that other coaches would soon take a similar approach, and he intended to prove them all wrong. "Everyone's going to make me take the outside shot," he said derisively. Also coming into clarity was the evolving relationship between the league and television. NBC had outbid CBS for the NBA's broadcast deal, putting millions of new dollars into players' pockets. Jordan's own contract, renegotiated just 2 years earlier, was already obsolete, leaving him as only the seventh highest paid player in the league. Even worse, Pippen's renegotiated contract had him earning about $760,000 that year, when many of his lesser teammates were making more than $1 million. Pippen thought it a good idea to hide out in a Memphis hotel room rather than report for training camp that season, until his agent convinced him that such a path would be disastrous. The financial issues would cause tremendous discord within the Chicago franchise over the coming decade, as it became clear to players and their agents just how tough a businessman Reinsdorf was. The owner prized the art of the deal above everything, and had long ago made up his mind to avoid the bad player contracts that paralyzed so many teams. He had a strict policy of avoiding renegotiating deals at all costs, and while he might have done so for Jordan, Reinsdorf knew that his star would not ask for a raise, which meant that he could take his time evaluating the situation. The team chairman's approach to winning the deals with his players and their agents involved a time-worn tactic of the lowball. It was Krause's job to make extremely low offers that infuriated players and their agents. Then Reinsdorf would step in with a better offer. But the owner knew what used car dealers knew. If you start with a lowball, you usually wind up getting the other side to give up too much in the deal. While effective, that approach meant that Jordan wasn't the only player on the roster who despised Krause. An array of the Bulls and their agents held the GM in special contempt. Over the summer of 1990, Krause had drafted a Croatian teen sensation named Tony Kukoc, but still had to convince him to play for the Bulls at some point. At the time, European players were largely ineffective in the far more physical NBA. Krause's excitement over Kukoc only drove Jordan's sense of demichaelization as the team began trying to come up with endorsements and side deals to lure Kukoc, who was under contract to a European team. When Jordan and Pippen learned that Krause was working to squirrel away $2 million of salary cap space to cover the costs of bringing Kukoc to America, that only inflamed them further. It was hardly the ideal time for Jackson to reveal that the team would again use the equal opportunity offense and to suggest that Jordan's scoring and minutes played should drop for the good of the team. But like that, the die had been cast. It would be Jackson's wits versus Jordan's will. Of course, both would have plenty of the opposite measure. Jordan truly liked Jackson and wanted to cooperate, but only within limits. After 6 seasons in the league with a variety of coaches and teammates, Jordan believed mostly in himself. In Mike he trusted. All others were open to question. That was the condition under which they would all have to proceed in the fall of 1990. Part 8. Something Gained. Chapter 26. Triangular. One of Jordan's simple escapes when he managed to land for a few days in Chicago was the couch at his mother-in-law's house on the South Side, where he could zone out on TV and load up on Dorothy Van Noy's old-fashioned mac and cheese. Juanita was 6 months pregnant with an active 2-year-old underfoot. She, too, sought the sanctuary of her mother's home. It was as good a place as any for Jordan to keep track of Krause's off-season maneuverings to upgrade the roster. The Bulls had had money to spend that offseason to fix several serious issues with the roster. Jackson liked big guards, big perimeter defenders to work his pressure defense. Plus, Bach had pointed out that they needed a tough, veteran guard who could stand up to Jordan and tell him to go to hell when he started pushing too hard and taking over the offense. Danny Ainge fit that bill and was available in Sacramento, but the Kings were controlled mostly by former Bulls coach Dick Motta, who was not about to make any deals that would help his old nemesis Jerry Krause. Once again, the focus turned to Walter Davis, who was now a free agent with Denver. Jordan agreed to renegotiate part of his contract to help the Bulls around salary cap issues, but only if they would use the money to sign Davis. The deal seemed to have momentum until Davis's wife made it known she wanted to remain in Denver. Jordan was stunned. So Krause decided to acquire New Jersey's Dennis Hobson, a former Big Ten player of the year and a high first-round draft pick, for guard depth. For defensive help at small forward, they added Cliff Levingston, a free agent out of Atlanta. Krause also signed undrafted free agent forward Scott Williams out of North Carolina. Jordan was elated to finally have a fellow Tar Heel on the roster and took Williams under his wing. Two of the team's first-round draft picks from 1989, B.J. Armstrong and Stacey King, had matured a bit and were considered ready to provide more help. Most important was yet more development from Pippen, who made the transition from being a wing into a point guard role, Jackson said. He became a guy who now had the ball as much as Michael. He became a dominant force. Pippen arrived in training camp with 3 years of experience battling Jordan in practice. The transformation in his competitive attitude could now be measured in his desire to score. He too wanted to be like Mike. More specifically, he wanted more money out of the team. To get it in this stats-driven business, he realized that he had to score. The only problem was that his new hunger would throw yet another monkey wrench into Jackson's plan for using the triangle. The Bulls encountered turbulence just out of the gate with a loss to Philly in which Sir Charles outscored his Airness 37-34. The smack-talking gab-fest was on between the two then. The Bulls went on to make it three straight losses to begin the season, then plotted to a 5-6 record over the first 3 weeks, which didn't fit at all with anyone's expectations. It was in the ninth game in Seattle that Jordan and mouthy rookie Gary Payton started trading trash talk in advance of the game. Jordan scored 33, and the Bulls won handily, but he played just 27 minutes, which increased his anxiety about Jackson's efforts to prevent him from winning the scoring title. Release. The mediocre start had prompted at least one phone call from Reinsdorf to Jackson to check in, but only the closest watchers saw any signs of perspiration out of the coach. It wasn't the phone call that troubled Jackson nearly as much as the routine sight of Jordan and Pippen ignoring Winter's offense and instead attacking the defense one-on-one. Jordan's conspirator and early instigator in these departures was Johnny Bock, who whispered his opinion. Johnny would say, "Fuck the triangle, just take the ball and score. Get everyone else to clear out," Jordan recalled. Jackson would tolerate Bock's insubordination only so long, but it played an important role in the evolution of the team's style of play. "He had to be released from the offense sometimes," Bock explained in a 2012 interview, adding that he believed his input was needed. Bock believed in Winter's offense, but he also saw that the team star needed to make his own adjustment to it. Jordan was a master at reading defenses, so picking up the triangle was a charm for him. And while there was no shortage of drama, something else was happening. Jordan, who had once readily given himself over to Dean Smith's offense, was exploring ways he could use the triangle to his advantage. "It was fascinating to watch Jordan's intelligence at work in that situation," Bock recalled, "almost like a brilliant actor bringing his own masterful interpretation to a great script while rewriting entire scenes and dialogue." "The player has to be aware of how he fits into things," Bock explained, looking back. "Michael knew the triple post backward and forward. He could play any position in it." By and large, the triangle offense provided a format that allowed Jordan to relate to his less talented teammates. The structure of the triangle demanded that the ball be passed to the open man. Once Jordan began complying with that, once he trusted enough to do that, the tension began to ease. A system quickly evolved in which Jordan would play within the triangle for three quarters, and then, depending on the pace and rhythm of the game, would break out of the offense in the fourth quarter to go on scoring binges. These fourth quarters each night produced their own tension, with Tex Winter anxious that Jordan was trying to do too much by himself. Some nights, when he did just that, the team would stumble. But far more often, the result would be mesmerizing. Jordan's life off the court during the season had fallen into a familiar pattern. He'd either stay in his room for marathon card games with his tight circle, or he'd slip off to a nearby golf course to zip through a round or two. He'd often manage this in the afternoons, after practice, while his teammates were napping. As the season progressed, the team found enough balance to allow for the integration of Horace Grant, 12.8 points, 8.4 rebounds, and Paxson, 8.7 points while shooting 5-48 from the floor. A key problem was the bench's inability to hold leads. Armstrong, Hodges, Perdue, King, Levingston, Williams, and Hobson all worked hard to execute the offense, but it remained Jordan's scoring that made things work. He would get irritated by the bench's struggles, but it ultimately meant more time on the floor for him and more scoring opportunities. More importantly, it was the defense that carried them along after the shaky start. Bock's presence served to energize, but the assistant coach would suggest that his contribution was merely window dressing next to the commitment and effort Jackson put into making defense a large part of his team's identity. "I had a little part in the defense," he explained, "but it took Phil to manifest it and make it clear to the team." This clarity resulted in the first signs that they might be a very good team. In December, the Bulls' defense held the Cleveland Cavaliers to just 5 points in one quarter at Chicago Stadium, where crowds presented an atmosphere as intimidating as the defense. The Bulls lost to Boston in Chicago the third game of the season. They wouldn't lose at home again until Houston stopped them March 25th, a run of 30 straight home wins. The defense essentially bought time for the offense to come along. When it did, the role players such as Paxson began to prosper. John Paxson was one of the people who made all of the difference in the world because of his attitude, the coach recalled, looking back in 1995. He was going to play full court pressure and be a facilitator in this offense. They finished February with an 11-1 record, which included a road win in the Palace of Auburn Hills just before All-Star weekend. Isaiah Thomas was sidelined, but the victory sparked the Bulls toward the first signs of belief. Just winning a game in their building gave us confidence because we'd had such a tough time beating them, Paxson recalled. Phil had sold us on playing our game, not being retaliatory against the Pistons. That's what really helped us along. The outcome charged Jordan with optimism and yet more confidence, if that was possible. When we went in there and beat them right before the All-Star break, that's when I knew we could beat them in the playoffs, he recalled. We had been on the road for something like 2 weeks, and it just came together. I could feel it then. The 7'1" Cartwright had been key to the Bulls' new maturity in dealing with the physical Pistons. Cartwright could be as stubborn as Jordan, which also helped the team learn to face up to Detroit. One of the things that got to us, Jackson explained, was that Detroit used to have a way of bringing up the level of animosity in a game. At some level, you were going to have to contest them physically if you were going to stay in the game with them. If you didn't want to stay in the game with them, fine, they'd go ahead and beat you. But if you wanted to compete, then you'd have to do something physically to play at their level. Bill stood up to the Pistons. Bill's statement was, "This isn't the way we want to play. This isn't the way I want to play. But if it is the way we have to play to take care of these guys, I'm not afraid to do it. I'm going to show these Detroit guys this is not acceptable. We won't accept you doing this to us." You can't imagine how much that relieved guys like Scottie Pippen and Horace Grant, guys who were being besieged constantly and challenged constantly by more physical guys like Dennis Rodman and Rick Mahorn. March brought a 9-game winning streak that helped them gain the all-important home court advantage for the playoffs. They closed the schedule with another 4-game win streak, including another win over the Pistons that brought Chicago's record to 61-21. Determined to prove his point and still fulfill Jackson's wishes, Jordan managed again to lead the league in scoring at 31.5 points per game, to go with 6 rebounds and 5 assists per outing. Pippen had found a higher plateau for his game as well. He played 3,014 minutes that season and averaged nearly 18 points, 7 rebounds, and 6 assists. As the playoffs got underway, Jordan was named the league's MVP for the second time. They opened against the Knicks and won the first game by a record 41 points, then went on to sweep them 3-0. Next, Charles Barkley and the 76ers fell 4-1. During a 2-day break in the playoff series with Philadelphia, Jordan and writer Mark Vansell motored over to an Atlantic City casino. They dragged back to the team hotel about 6:30 the next morning, and Jordan still made the Bulls practice at 10 a.m., which was no great surprise to anyone who knew him. The media took note of it, and later it would be cited as the first tremor in his rolling quake of troubles. Basketball brought him back to a reality of sorts. The Bulls dispensed with the Sixers, setting up the only rematch that Jordan wanted, the Bad Boys in the Eastern Conference Championship Series. Detroit was an injured and fractured team in May 1991. Chuck Daly had been named the coach for the upcoming 1992 U.S. Olympic team, and Isaiah Thomas returned from injury that April, perhaps sensing that he wasn't in Daly's plans for the roster. He began publicly criticizing his coach, hinting that his Olympic responsibilities had taken his attention off the Pistons. Daly sought to quiet his star, but Thomas persisted in his pointed remarks. Privately, Daly was said to be furious at the suggestion he wasn't doing his job. "All I've done is one meeting and look at some films," he told reporters. Jordan and his teammates clearly smelled blood. The Pistons managed to make a strong rush early in Game 1. "We were beating them in the first game," recalled Brendan Malone. "That's the quietest I have ever heard Chicago Stadium." And then off the bench came Cliff Levingston, Will Perdue, and Craig Hodges. Levingston and Perdue went to work on the glass, and Hodges was red hot in that series. With that spark, the Bulls went on to take the first 3 games with an attitude. They were executing their triangle offense better, and that gave them the edge, Malone recalled. They had gotten better with more time in the offense. It was difficult to double-team Michael and leave someone wide open. Ultimately, Winter's offense had created some operating room for Jordan and produced open shooters around him. After the series, the Pistons would be left to answer criticism that they had focused too much on Jordan and left his teammates with good, clean shots. "You have to put the majority of your focus on him," Dumars said, looking back at the season. "It's hard to go on the floor and not focus on that guy because he can dominate so much of what happens. It's hard to walk on the floor and not think about what he's going to do." On the eve of Game 4 in Detroit, the atmosphere around the series turned harsh when Jordan unleashed his pent-up anger in a press conference. "The people I know are going to be happy they're not the reigning champs anymore," he said of the Pistons. "We'll get back to the image of a clean game. People want to push this kind of basketball out. When Boston was champion, they played true basketball. Detroit won. You can't take that away from them. But it wasn't clean basketball. It wasn't the kind of basketball you want to endorse. We're not going to try to lower ourselves to that kind of play. I may talk some trash, but we're playing hard, clean basketball. They've tried to provoke us, and we've kept our poise." Jordan then concluded boldly, "I think we can sweep this team." The Pistons, particularly Thomas, were enraged by his tone and comments. "No, we're not going to get swept," Thomas vowed. Dumars made no such claims, but he was taken aback by Jordan's antipathy. "It surprised me," the Detroit guard confided later. "I was disappointed that he started badmouthing what our championships had meant to us." Brendan Malone, however, had seen the end coming for Detroit's physical style earlier in the playoffs when NBA Commissioner David Stern said he was shocked by what he saw as hard fouls and thuggery starting to become the approach of other teams as well. "That type of basketball ended," Malone said. "I think it stopped when David Stern went to the playoffs that year and saw players get into a fight right in front of him. He decided he was going to clamp down on the physical play in the NBA. Officials then hit the Pistons with a flurry of flagrant foul calls early in their series with the Bulls, Malone said. "One was on Joe Dumars, who was physical but who wasn't considered over the top. And I knew then the league had made a decision that you couldn't play that way anymore." As he had forecast, Jordan exerted his will the next day, and Chicago swept Detroit. At the end of the game, Thomas and the Pistons stalked off the floor without shaking hands or congratulating the Bulls. Daly had asked them not to do it. The snub angered television viewers and Chicago fans, and perhaps cost Isaiah Thomas an opportunity to be on the Olympic team. "It was incredibly satisfying, the fact that they had to walk by our bench," John Paxson recalled on the 20th anniversary of the victory. "You could still see Isaiah was kind of ducking down, shoulders kind of slouched, trying not to be seen. But it did kind of validate what we believed in, that we played the right way. They were really good, but their time had come and gone, and it was our turn now." Rather than join Thomas in the protest, Dumars stopped to congratulate his foe. He too was upset with Jordan's comments, but he remembered the pain in Jordan's face at the end of each of the previous seasons. "That look is the reason I stopped and shook his hand when they beat us," Dumars recalled in 2012. "I was not going to walk past the guy and not shake his hand. I shook Phil's hand and Michael's hand and a few of the other guys. I figured, if that guy can shake my hand with that kind of hurt and disappointment he had in his face, there's no way I'm going to walk off this court and not shake his hand." Thomas and the rest of the Pistons had been enraged by what they saw as Jordan's disrespect, Malone recalled. "That was also Phil Jackson and Tex Winter," the Detroit assistant said. "It was an attitude that their way was the only way to play basketball. I thought that was insulting. There are all kinds of ways to play basketball. They had that attitude. But it was just their time to win. Horace Grant and Scottie Pippen had matured and were ready to play. Pippen really came of age, and so did Horace Grant. And Michael finally had some help to win a championship." Dumars attributed some of the incident to the fact that Thomas was simply a poor loser. The Detroit star had also reacted poorly 4 years earlier after a loss to the Celtics. "Isaiah has never said to me, 'I hate Michael Jordan,'" Dumars explained in 2012. "He has said to me, 'I hate losing.' Regardless of who it was, Isaiah would have hated losing that series. That's what I make of the situation." The snub was a slap in the face, a final insult for the Bulls, and it ensured that their hard feelings against Detroit would endure. "I have nothing but contempt and disgust for the Pistons organization," Jerry Reinsdorf said, looking back 4 years later. Ultimately, David Stern felt the pressure and made rules changes to outlaw their style of play. "It wasn't basketball, it was thuggerism, hoodlumism. That's one of the things that made us so popular. We were the White Knights, we were the good guys, we beat the bad boys 4-0, and they sulked off the court the way they did. I remember saying at the time that this was a triumph of good over evil. They were hated because they had used that style to vanquish first the Celtics and then the Lakers, who had been the NBA's most popular teams for years." The vanquishing of the bad boys had been such a hurdle for Jordan and his Bulls that even though they still faced the league championship series, they couldn't help but pause for celebration, memorably kicked off by Jerry Krause. He comes in the front of the plane and he's celebrating, Jackson recalls. He's dancing, and the guys are going, "Go Jerry, go Jerry." The days of mooing had been put on hold, but the players still had no idea what to make of their most unusual GM. "He's dancing," Jackson recalled with a grin, "or whatever he's doing, and when he stops, they all collapse in hilarity, this laughter, and you couldn't tell whether it was with him or at him. It was one of those nebulous moments. It was wild." Magic Time. In the recent past, the Bulls had pondered acquiring both Danny Ainge and Buck Williams, but both of those players wound up in Portland with Clyde Drexler. The Trail Blazers had ruled the 1991 regular season in the Western Conference with a 63-19 finish, but the long-dominant Lakers, led by Magic Johnson, found a way to prevail in the conference finals and ousted Portland 4-2. Suddenly, Chicago was hosting the opening of a dream of a championship series for basketball fans. Michael versus Magic, the Bulls versus the Lakers, and ticket manager Joe O'Neill found himself in a nightmare situation. It had never been easy finding enough home game tickets for Jordan while avoiding making his teammates angry. As the Bulls began moving farther into the playoffs and playing bigger games, the ticket challenge grew, particularly in terms of meeting Jordan's demands. "I kind of knew the number he was looking at," O'Neill recalled. "I was told him, 'Don't surprise me. Don't tell me you need 20 tickets at the last minute,' which he did all the time." One of the biggest issues was finessing Jordan's requests while keeping Pippen and Grant happy, O'Neill explained. "I remember going into the locker room telling Scotty and Horace and the guys, 'You get 4 extra tickets for the game. Don't ask me for any more. There are no more tickets. That's it. 4 tickets for everybody.' Then I'd hand Michael a packet of like 40. The issue grew so large that O'Neill told Jordan to hide his tickets from his teammates. Finally, the ticket manager began meeting Jordan surreptitiously in a hockey locker room in Chicago Stadium to give him the tickets. Ticket demand got out of control once it became clear that the Bulls would be hosting the Lakers in Game 1. "We were about 4 days out from the final starting, and I was overwhelmed," O'Neill remembered of that first year. "I didn't have enough tickets. Michael needed this, and everybody needed this. I remember going home, getting home about 7 that night, and walking in to my wife and saying, 'Susan, I don't think I can do this. I'm overwhelmed. The whole world is coming after me. It's Michael versus Magic. I don't have enough tickets. I don't think I can do this anymore.' My wife said to me, 'I have an idea. Why don't you take out the garbage?' So I walked out and took out the garbage. I'm pulling it out to the street, and the light goes on across the street, and the guy runs out, hands me a credit card and says, 'I hate to do this to you, Joe, but can you get me 2? I go back in the house and tell my wife, "I got an order for 2 taking out the garbage." This wasn't the first time a matchup of Michael and Magic created an instant and controversial demand. In 1990, promoters planned to stage a one-on-one game between Johnson and Jordan for pay-per-view television. Jordan, who had spent his life challenging people to one-on-one, found the idea immediately fetching. But the NBA nixed the event, which would have paid big money to the participants, after Isaiah Thomas, who was then the president of the Players Association, objected. Jordan lashed out at Thomas's intervention, charging that the Detroit guard was jealous because no one would pay to see him play. Johnson said he would love to play the game, but he declined to get involved in the scrap between the two. "That's their thing," he said. Johnson did, however, have some fun speculating over the outcome. Actor Jack Nicholson, the Lakers superfan, said that if he was a betting man, he'd put his money on Jordan, the premier individual player in the game, as opposed to Johnson, who is considered pro basketball's consummate team player. Johnson, though, refused to concede any speculation. "I've been playing one-on-one all my life," he said. "That's how I made my lunch money." Asked his best one-on-one move, Johnson said, "I didn't have a best move. My best move was just to win, and that's it. I did what I had to do to win." Basketball fans were disappointed that the one-on-one match wasn't held. "A lot of people wanted to see it," Johnson said at the time. "Michael is really disappointed. His people are disappointed. We're all disappointed. It was something we were all looking forward to." That summer of 1990, Jordan had agreed to play in Magic's charity All-Star game, but tried to consume too many golf holes the day of the event and arrived late. Rather than start the event without the star of the league, Johnson had decided to delay it to give Jordan time to be there for tip-off, which reportedly infuriated Isaiah Thomas. Apparently, Jordan was delighted that he had inconvenienced his nemesis. With the championship series, Magic Mike of Laney High was finally coming face-to-face with his hero. Johnson, having led the Lakers to 5 NBA titles, was seen as the ultimate purveyor of the team game, while Jordan was the one-man show who couldn't seem to keep from referring to his teammates as his supporting cast, no matter how many times he was reminded not to do so. As if that wasn't trip enough down memory lane, Jordan also faced his two college teammates, James Worthy and Sam Perkins. Worthy had a badly sprained ankle, which greatly reduced his mobility. Some insiders figured that Worthy's injury would cost the Lakers the series. His loss would be a tremendous blow to Los Angeles. Others, such as former Lakers coach Pat Riley, who was broadcasting the series for NBC, projected that the Lakers would still use their experience to win. Jordan and his Bulls played nervously out of the gate, but still managed a 2-point lead at halftime in the first game. The second half, however, became a matter of the Lakers' postgame, run through Perkins, Vlade Divac, and Worthy, versus Chicago's jump shooting. It came down to jump shots at the end. Perkins hit an unlikely 3-pointer, while Jordan missed an 18-footer at the buzzer to give Los Angeles Game 1, 93-91. Jordan scored 36 with 12 assists, 8 rebounds, and 3 steals on 14 of 24 shooting from the floor, but even this magnificent performance left some of his teammates quietly fuming about his shot selection and one-on-one play. Although his team had just lost the home court advantage, Jackson actually seemed relieved after the game. He had seen that Los Angeles struggled any time Johnson was out of the game. Jackson figured that would prove too great a burden for a player at the end of his career, and he was right. There was another development that Jackson hadn't foreseen. He had begun the series with the 6'6 Jordan defending the 6'9 Johnson, and in Game 2, that effort brought Jordan 2 early fouls. His teammates, particularly Grant and Cartwright in the post, had already gotten off to strong starts. Jordan's time on the bench did 2 things. It gave them more opportunities, and it meant that the taller Pippen would move to cover Johnson. At the time, there was an assumption that the 25-year-old would struggle to handle basketball's wiliest veteran, the master point guard of his time. Just the opposite happened. The long-armed Pippen immediately limited Johnson, and suddenly the momentum shifted. With Jordan and Pippen taking turns guarding him, the Lakers' big guard shot just 4 of 13 from the floor. Pippen, meanwhile, contributed 20 points with 10 assists and 5 rebounds as the Bulls won Game 2 in a swarm. "We started to see that we were wearing him down from a physical standpoint," Pippen happily recalled, "especially myself being able to go up and harass him and trying to get him out of their offense. He wasn't as effective as he had been in the past against some teams, being able to post up and take advantage of situations. I saw the frustration there." "Some of it was to rest Michael," recalled Johnny Bock. "We didn't want him on Magic all the time. Scotty went in, and suddenly we realized that he was so long and so big that Magic could not throw those over-the-top passes. We called them halo passes, right over the top of the head. He would throw the ball right past littler guys. But now Scotty was in front of him. He was really a little taller than the 6'7 he said he was. Scotty had long arms and big hands. And Magic was starting to fade. He was getting older. Youth doesn't wait for the aged." Jordan had opened the game in a generous mood, sending no-look passes to Cartwright and Grant for easy baskets. From that beginning, the Bulls shot better than 73% from the floor to drive a blowout, 107-86. Jordan made 15 of 18 from the floor to finish with 33, plus 13 assists, 7 rebounds, 2 steals, and a block. Jordan scored 13 straight field goals through the heart of the second half, a streak capped by perhaps his most memorable attempt with a little under 8 minutes left in the game. He took a pass at the top of the key and attacked the basket head-on through traffic. He rose in the lane with the ball outstretched high in his right hand to dunk until he encountered a defender, then switched to his left at the last instant and reached around the left side of the goal to flip in a bank shot that left the building buzzing, Phil Jackson smiling and shaking his head, and broadcaster Marv Albert raving. This one would be labeled the move to sit in tandem with the shot from 1989 against Cleveland. Even with his grand performance, Jordan was outshot by Paxson, who went 8-for-8 from the floor. "Does Paxson ever miss?" Perkins asked afterward. Perhaps the thorniest issue was Jordan's taunting of the Lakers' bench as the blowout unfolded, pumping his arms or appearing to give the dice a shake and a roll after he made baskets, especially the move. Los Angeles would file a complaint about him with league offices, and even his teammates attempted to restrain him. Despite the loss, the Lakers had gotten a split in Chicago Stadium and were headed home for 3 straight games in the Great Western Forum. They had a huge advantage in experience over the Bulls, and just about all of the experts figured that would be the difference. The first order of business for the Bulls before Game 3 was a videotape Jackson had prepared, showing Johnson sagging off Paxson to play his own and create havoc for the Chicago offense. Jordan had to recognize this and give up the ball to the open shooter, the coach emphasized, a message he would repeat after each of the next two games. Even though Jordan averaged better than 11 assists during the 1991 championship series, the issue hung over the team. Having Pippen defend Johnson in Game 3 backfired on Chicago in the second half, as the Lakers moved to a 13-point lead when center Vlade Divac found it easier to score over the shorter Jordan. The Bulls narrowed the lead to a half dozen at the end of the third, and trouble caught up with the Lakers from there. Johnson continued to weary from the heavy minutes he had to play, and Worthy's ankle finally became the factor the Lakers' coaches had feared it would. Jordan hit a jumper with 3.4 seconds left to send Game 3 into overtime. There, the Bulls ran off 8 straight points for a 104-96 win and a 2-1 lead in the series. In Game 4, the Bulls harried Los Angeles into shooting 37% from the floor. They managed a total of 30 points over the second and third quarters. Perkins in particular found the going difficult in the low post while shooting one of 15 from the floor. Cartwright led an interior defense that delivered a 97-82 win. Jordan turned in yet another stellar night in his first championship series with 28 points, 13 assists, 5 rebounds, and 2 blocks. "I can't believe this is happening," Magic Johnson told reporters. "It's no surprise the way they've been defending," Laker coach Mike Dunleavy said of the Bulls. "They are very athletic and very smart." Suddenly, the Bulls were on the verge of the improbable, but they'd have to be patient. "We went up 3-1 and had a long wait from Sunday to Wednesday for Game 5, recalled Bulls equipment manager John Ligmanowski. "Those 3 days took forever. Before we had even won it, Michael would get on the bus and say, 'Hey, how does it feel, world champs?' He knew. That was a pretty good feeling. We just couldn't wait to get it over with." The eve of Game 5 brought a meal of crow for Jordan. He publicly acknowledged what Cartwright had done for the team. "He has given us an edge in the middle," he said. "He has been solid for us. This guy has turned out to be one of the most important factors for this ball club, and he has surprised many who are standing here and who play with him." Later, told of Jordan's comments, Cartwright brushed them off. "That stuff really isn't important to me," he said. "I've always figured what goes around comes around. What's really important to me is winning a championship." Every Bulls starter had taken at least 10 shots in Game 4, a testament perhaps to Jordan's trust and proof that Jackson had a will of his own. He had rarely confronted Jordan directly in his time coaching the team. When he wanted Jordan to do something, he would often tell the team it was time to do it. When he had criticism for Jordan, it was instead directed at the team. It was a means of communication that the coach and star player would settle into over the course of their years together. They both obviously knew what was going on and found the practice acceptable. The other players on the team would sometimes complain about it quietly, but they too accepted it as a quirk of the circumstances. As Game 5 twisted toward its conclusion, this dynamic produced a moment of lore, one that Jordan's teammates, and even future teammates, would come to treasure. With the championship hanging in the balance, with John Paxson open and Jordan ignoring him while continuing to attack mostly one-on-one, Jackson asked impatiently during a late timeout, "MJ, who's open?" Perhaps stunned by Jackson's sudden directness, Jordan said nothing. So Jackson asked again, "Who's open?" The story has been passed along by the many Jordan teammates who supposedly suffered his demands and indifference over the years. "It's one of my favorite stories," Steve Kerr, who filled Paxson's role on subsequent Bulls teams, said in a 2012 interview. "Michael's having a rough second half. They're double-teaming him, and he's forcing some shots. And Phil calls a timeout with, like, minutes left in the game. And he's looking right at Michael, and he goes, 'Michael, who's open?' And Michael won't look up. He goes, 'Michael, who's open?' Finally, Michael looks up at him and goes, 'Pax.' And Phil goes, 'Well, throw him the fucking ball.'" Paxson would make 5 long buckets in the final 4 minutes as time and again Jordan penetrated, drew the defense, then kicked it out. Paxson would finish with 20 and Pippen 32 as the Bulls closed out the championship with a 108-101 win in Game 5. The moment was met by a numbed silence from the forum crowd, recalled Bulls broadcaster Jim Durham in 2011. "The one thing I'll remember is the Bulls dancing off the floor and everybody else just sitting there watching it." On the floor in the quiet aftermath, Laker superfan Jack Nicholson hugged Jackson, and Magic Johnson sought out Jordan to offer his congratulations. The two had become closer during the series after Johnson approached Jordan and told him that they needed to forget their differences. The event was the true beginning of their friendship, Jordan would say later. I saw tears in his eyes, Johnson said of their conversation after the final buzzer. I told him, you proved everyone wrong. You're a winner as well as a great individual basketball player. The tears became a tide as Jordan made his way through the bedlam of the locker room to inhabit the moment he'd sought for 7 years. I never lost hope, he said as his wife and father sat nearby. I'm so happy for my family and this team and this franchise. It's something I've worked 7 years for, and I thank God for the talent and the opportunity that I've had. That scene with Michael crying, with his dad, and with his arms around him, Jim Durham recalled. Finally, he had won, and he had won doing it his way. Once the tears started, Jordan couldn't seem to hold them back. I've never been this emotional publicly, he said. When I came here, we started from scratch. I vowed we'd make the playoffs every year, and each year we got closer. I always had faith I'd get this ring one day. Delivering the final game had come down to Paxson hitting the open shots, Jordan said of the moment that Jackson had forced upon him. That's why I've always wanted him on my team, and why I wanted him to stay on my team. It was done and over, and it was dramatic, like a blitzkrieg, Jackson recalled. Afterward, there was a lot of joy. There was Michael holding the trophy and weeping. It was special. Later, the Bulls took the party to their headquarters at the Ritz-Carlton in Marina del Rey. I remember going up to Michael's room, John Ligmanowski said. He told me to order like a dozen bottles of Dom Perignon and enough hors d'oeuvres for 40 people. We're at the Ritz-Carlton, and I called down to the concierge, and I said, yeah, send up a dozen bottles of Dom and hors d'oeuvres for 40 people. So they were like, wait a second. They didn't want to send it up because they knew it wasn't Michael on the phone. So I handed the phone to him. He grabbed the phone and said, send it up. The Bulls returned to Chicago and celebrated their championship in Grant Park before a crowd estimated at between 500,000 and 1 million fans. We started from the bottom, Jordan told the sea of happy faces, and it was hard working our way to the top, but we did it. Behind the scenes, winning it all seemed to ease the conflict between Jordan and Krause. We wound up winning that first championship, Jim Stack remembered, and Michael never said anything again publicly about whether we needed to make this trade or that move. There was a begrudging respect that Michael finally gave Jerry, but Jerry really had to go out of his way to earn it. In those early years, Michael was really relentless on Jerry in terms of his basketball acumen. In the wake of the championship, Jordan eased Krause out of his crosshairs, Stack recalled. The hatred subsided there for a while. Chapter 27. The Gamble. After taking his team to the promised land, Jordan abruptly veered into the wilderness, even as Gatorade was preparing to release its Tour de Force ad with that overpowering refrain, I want to be like Mike. Time would reveal that the limitations to what he could achieve in basketball were largely self-imposed. While he had just claimed his first pro championship, and thus had begun to refute criticism about his ability to be a team player, Jordan had already embarked on a path in his off-court life that threatened the good name he had built so carefully. That summer, Jordan and Richard Esquinas, the part owner of the San Diego Sports Arena, engaged in a series of high-stakes golf matches and began keeping a running tab of their wins and losses. We were always very flexible in payments, Esquinas would recall later. The gambling hit a new level that September in Pinehurst, North Carolina, when Esquinas lost $98,000 to Jordan in a day of golf. He wanted Jordan to take a double or nothing bet, and to emphasize that, he wrote Jordan two checks for $98,000 each. What he didn't tell Jordan was that he wasn't sure he had the funds to cover either. He wouldn't have to, as it turned out. Jordan accepted the bet, and the two gamblers went at each other later that month over an adrenaline-fed 10-day spree at the Aviara Golf Club in San Diego. Jordan not only lost the $98,000, but ended up down an additional $626,000. Jordan, too, wanted a double or nothing. Esquinas, who was on a hot streak, said he pleaded with Jordan not to go double or nothing, but finally agreed to it. Once again, he went into a long story about his wealth, Esquinas would later recall. He could handle $1.2 million, he said, should he happen to lose. Let's play for it, he said. E-man, I can't believe you won't give me this game. I was trying to get him to comprehend the magnitude of losing at such a level, to defer this insistence that we engage once again. Not only did he want to continue this chase, he was demanding it. I do not want this game, I said, but I must be honest with you. You lose and you pay. That's the only way I'll give you a shot. and if I beat you, that's it, no more of this double or nothing. Jordan promptly lost, bringing his total debt to what Esquinas claimed was $1.252 million. He seemed a bit shaken after the loss, but returned home to Wilmington for the